I have as one of the authors, as Nick was, of the Montana Climate Assessment. We have spent the last 2 years. It was published in 2017. We have spent the last 2 years going around the state and talking about the climate assessment. A lot of that focus was to folks in agriculture. In reaching out to about 4,000 people in Montana, which is significant in our state, with only 1 million people in it, I've only had two cases where, and they were both through emails, from people that were basically climate deniers that were interested in raising the conversation about how there's issues with what we're promoting here or something, though we have an agenda. I think we've met this question with a lot of objectivity, and I'll start with the fact that no, we don't know it all. We try to understand systems. When it comes to ecology, it's especially challenging because we're looking at interaction of all these things, all the climate factors, all of the kinds of other things that are going on with land use change that all complicate an issue of how organisms start to interact. So keep in mind that's a real challenge. And as I tell my students in ecology, ecology isn't rocket science. It's way harder. So I think that's the initial point. So I'm going to talk a little bit about climate change impacts on ecosystems, species distribution changes. A lot of this is what we've already seen. So it correlates with the rises in temperature and the things that go along with it. It is correlative, but we're pretty convinced, as are 98% of the scientists in the world, that this is real, that relationship is real. And we can do the experiment in the little jars and show that this works. Water vapor plays a role, but it hasn't been changing as much over time as the temperature. So these are complicated interactions, there's no doubt about it. But people have tackled that particular question. And the gentleman that raised it left, unfortunately. But all I'm saying is that they have worked at this, and every time these kinds of issues come up, there's been a real concentration, a real effort to try to understand, is that a meaningful kind of argument against what we're doing? Scientists in general trying their best to be objective and trying to look at every question that comes up about whether climate change is really real or not. We continue to be convinced. And that's what I'm saying, to the degree that we have never stood up before about our science and said, we better do something. And what's to lose? What's to lose by doing something? Even if we're wrong or half wrong. You know, conservation of energy is probably a pretty darn good idea. So I have to say that. I think that's really important. So I'm going to look at these things, a number of things about the ecology of our systems and how we think about them and how we are addressing these issues to some degree, although I'm going to concentrate mostly on what have we seen. So I'm going to start with a little primer about ecosystems here. Ecosystems we tend to think of, and each one of these bubbles is probably a community or maybe it's a species population. And we tend to organize those in trophic levels. So there's predators at the top, or top predators, consumers, herbivores, producers, and detritivores, or the microorganisms that chew up this material. So if we think about that system, and the connections between those are really important, and that's what basically makes an ecosystem and how an ecosystem functions, is by maintaining those black lines, those connections. So just from that basic point, we can start to ask, well, what happens? Well, that's how the system co-evolved. We can probably lose some of those organisms and still maintain function. We're still learning about that possibility. we can probably add some species and still maintain function. But what happens when you really start to change the fundamental aspects of what holds that together? So if we start to think about that co-evolved system and what happens when we start to cycle carbon through that system, because that's what it really does, and if we start to change that by all of a sudden inputting new carbon into it, that really changes some things, especially at certain levels. So I'm being general here, but I'll get into the specifics when I show you some examples. What's important is that climate change has to be put in the context of all the other things going on. So disrupted or novel kinds of ecosystems where we've taken a bunch of those species out of it, and this happens a lot. Whenever we do agriculture, we certainly do that. And I'm an agricultural scientist. I'm not complaining about agriculture as much as I want to say this is the kind of thing that's happened. When we break up landscapes, we tend to change this functionality and the cycling that goes up. So we make a simpler system. We decouple some of those things that give resilience to that system that basically buffer it from other kinds of changes like changing the carbon input into it. That's important. And it's not just carbon. We can also be keeping in mind that nitrogen cycles through those systems in a very important element. We can also ought to be thinking about the fact that water cycles through those systems is a very important part of it. So that's just the basics of how we think about ecosystems and how changes might occur in those. If we look at the 21st century ecological sensitivity right now, the predicted percentage of ecological landscapes being driven toward changes in plant species as a result of projected human-induced climate change by 2100, this is given the RCP 4.5, in fact, in this case. Well, we start to see these colors are showing you the percent change. There's a lot of change, and a lot of it is in the northern hemisphere. The southern hemisphere tends to be more buffered, at least by temperature, in that the buffering capacity, because it's so much more ocean, okay? So there's a real buffering capacity of the ocean. If you actually look at the CO2 concentrations even, their changes over the year are much greater in the northern hemisphere than in the southern hemisphere. So those are some things that drive some of these sensitivities. If we look at extinction risk from climate change, we're predicting out to a period here, predicted extinction rates from climate change by region and group. You can kind of see these aspects and where that's going to occur, where we expect it to occur for these different species. So we're talking about sizable numbers of extinctions of species in our systems based on just really more of the temperature than anything else. Those temperatures, species live within a certain thermal envelope. They can only exist in those and reproduce and be maintained. So we, using those, we can project out whether those species can really be maintained in the system. Now part of that is, can they move? And can we even assist them in moving? And that can change some of those numbers. So this doesn't include the assumption of moving. But we're already seeing major effects in places like coral reefs. So that's something that we don't deal with here in Montana, but in fact it has a huge impact on folks that live in oceanic areas. Looking at vulnerability to species diversity, we see that local, regional, continental, and global, you can kind of see that how that's apportioned in terms of how different species are really affected. It's interesting that birds are one of the more impacted when, in fact, they're probably the most mobile species, but are really sensitive to these thermal changes. Mammals, unfortunately, right behind those. We're a mammal, by the way. Plants, we really rely on. So we ought to be paying attention. When we look at rapid range shifts of species associated with high levels of climate warming, we see the latitudinal analysis latitudinal analysis that species have moved away from the equator or toward the poles at a rate of about 17.6 kilometers per decade. So That's averaging over a lot of species. This was a study that was done that included a large number of species that they looked at over the entire globe. And you can kind of see what's going on there. At the same time, we're driving species up the mountain. Okay, that climate is changing. So they have to move up, and that's coming at about 12.2 meters uphill per year, or sorry, per decade. So you kind of get a sense for they're advancing. But if you think about it on the mountain, rather than maybe the poleward thing, it's pretty soon they go off the top of the mountain, right? So that's an issue, and we'll talk about some specific cases there. In that same study, if you take all these different species, birds, mammals, arthropods, plants, reptiles, fish, all on this graph, and what we're looking at is that 50-50 diagonal line is one that says if what we expect based on the warming that's occurring, we would expect those species where they would occur in that space between expected and observed latitude shifts. We see that things are below that line. That's kind of good news, that it's not going as fast as we thought. But at the same time, they're all above the zero line, that horizontal line. So it is changing, and it's changing with some confidence. There's certain species groups that aren't. The triangles, which are the plants, is a little bit harder to judge, but nonetheless, the others are moving in this way. So that's with the latitudinal shift and the elevational shift. Again, both tend to be mostly above zero, and that's important, even though we're not exceeding that one-to-one line, perhaps. So it gives you a sense of where we're at in terms of our knowledge about how this might be changing species distributions. Now I'll give you a couple of specific examples. Aspen, the species that we're really common around here and we're familiar with. We're looking at some current 1971 to 2000 sort of range of that species on the left-hand side of the North American map there. And then you can see when it's projected using the RCP 8.5, which Nick talked about, from 2071 to 2100 is the other kind of response, or you see how it's pushed up toward the pole, and again it's kind of moving right out into a condition where that's a tree species that is very long lived but is moving, but that's one of the species we're going to have to move ourselves because it doesn't move that easily. So we're going to have to, if we want to keep that species, we're actually going to have to start to plant it in the Arctic. And that's not just that species. There's a whole realm of species like that. So that's a major undertaking. And to think about that and think about what its role is in that complex interaction of species is really important to think about and to start to say, can we save those keystone species that are really having the most impact on what that cycling and what the kinds of interactions are? So that's a big step. This is lodgepole pine. The core distribution versus the range of possible, in terms of its range, which is defined by temperatures primarily. In the year 2000, this was the distribution, and the core distribution is really important to watch over time because I'm going to show you a time series here. That core distribution is crucial because that's where a lot of the genetic diversity is for it to be able to adapt to different changes. So that's why it's separated from just the range at which it is or could be. So that core distribution starts to decline pretty rapidly. Again, this is using the 8.5. And this is the 2011 to 2040 projection, and then it's decreasing even more as we get out to 2070, and then at the end of the century, we're looking at lodgepole pine almost going away in most of North America, or certainly within its range. So again, that's a species that we would actually have to pick it up and move it. which we've been quite good at. In fact, I've spent about 10 of the last years studying how lodgepole pine has invaded the southern hemisphere, which it's really good at invading. But that's really changing, has a major change on an ecosystem that wasn't adapted to fire, and suddenly you put a very fire-adapted species in it, and they're having more and more forest fires there. It's really changing the ecology of that system. So that's a species that you don't want to move it there. You want to move it somewhere else. But if you do move it, you might have some major kinds of changes that you don't anticipate. So that's one of the issues of ecology and moving species around. Certainly most of our invasive species are a result of us moving them around. Change in latitude of bird center, bird abundance and bird species. As you can see, from 1965 to 2015, we've seen this trend. Birds are moving latitudinally and increasing use of higher latitudes. So a lot of species have been moving already. Some good example species here. There's a few of these in that have really advanced. One of them that went, this is showing kind of a latitudinal change, but it's showing that one of the species basically got moved right out of the system, got extirpated, the variable antrike. Here's a species that went up the mountain, basically. It got pushed up the mountain, but right off the top, effectively. Its habitat was so reduced. And there's other species following right behind it. And in these huge elevational gradients are places where you can observe that, like in Peru, where this study was done. That's that species that now has not been observed for a number of years. So this species that are more regulated by temperature, a lot of insect species, for example, this is kind of a graph that shows some of those. Insects, turtles, lizards, and frogs, these are some of the more susceptible species to changes in temperature. And what we're seeing is that even though there's where those impacts might be the greatest, and if they're positive impacts, that means that the species we would expect would increase. And that does happen. I'll show you some cases of that later. But if they're on the other side of that, they're in the negative side of impact, then they're declining. And what you can kind of see in a latitudinal way, where they're increasing, where they're decreasing. What's interesting is that where the major decreases will be, ecologically, is probably in the lower latitudes in the tropics. And the reason that is that in the tropics, a lot of the species there have evolved with a fairly constant temperature, doesn't change much over the year. And so they have lost an ability really to adapt to major changing temperature fluctuations. So they're some of the ones that will be affected most. So the tropics will see greater effects, probably the least in sort of this mid-temperate zone that we live in. So there's sort of a summary of the ecological and evolutionary responses here. Range-restricted species, particularly polar and mountaintop species, show severe range contraction and have been the first group in which entire species have gone extinct due to recent climate change. This was a large study done. Over 688 studies were looked at. This is the most, in terms of ecological response to climate change, this is the most cited paper we have out there. It really goes into depth on all these kinds of responses and is a very summarizing kind of an effect, and is held up as being really the state of what we know. Tropical coral reefs and amphibians have been most negatively affected. Predator-prey and plant-insect interactions have been disrupted when interacting species vary differently to warming. Evolutionary adaptation to warmer conditions have occurred in the interior of species ranges, and resource use and dispersal have evolved rapidly at expanding range margins. So this has been interesting in that this pattern is actually being verified, and since this study was done, and a research interest of mine, is at those margins is where the action is in an evolutionary point of view. and an adaptation point of view. And it's really interesting the variability from species to species and their ability to adapt to these new climates and new climate conditions. So I think that's emerging as an interesting story and one that we're learning more about all the time. But I think that's where the secret to the kinds of things that we might do to mitigate some of these changes, assuming we're not going to change, which, as Nick pointed out, we probably ought to do. But these are things that we're probably going to have to, some stopgap measures that we're going to have to employ. A little closer to home, we can look at a major climate change story. And this is one that has to do with white bark pine that's up near the top of our mountains. It's high elevation species. This is one of those species that we were worried could get moved off the top of the mountain. Interestingly, there's not good evidence for it moving up past the top of the mountain. In fact, we're starting to see it at lower elevations fairly frequently, so this is kind of not fitting the model. But nonetheless, what's interesting is the other connected effects. And that is that it's quite susceptible to an introduced disease, the white pine blister rust. And so that's killing a lot of the trees, and the trees especially that we see up at tree line that are dead are often white bark pine that are succumbed to that particular disease. And what follows that or is happens simultaneously, of course, are pine beetles which attack them. But what's important about that species is it really supports some pretty important top-level species. The grizzly bear, first of all, relies on the seeds produced by the white pine that's up at the high elevations. Similarly, the bird species, there's a number of bird species that depend on the seeds. The Clark's nutcracker is the major one. And then there are squirrels, which you can't see there. I guess you can't see it on most of these screens very well. Is dependent up at these elevations. And the woodpeckers play a role in that they actually would increase initially, but then decrease initially because there's a lot of dead trees around that they'll do great. But in fact, beyond that, then they start to decline because we don't have any of those trees. So that's an issue in the greater Yellowstone area and has been studied extensively by Andy Hansen, who's a professor here in ecology at Montana State. And they've done some really nice work here looking at different species distributions and capturing whether those distributions look like across an elevational gradient. So on the x-axis is elevation increasing off to the right, and then the frequency of these species at those different elevations throughout the greater Yellowstone area. And the one to look at, I guess, here is this curve here, this blue curve, which is the white bark pine. And you can see it's one of the ones that's the highest in the elevational gradient. But as we're seeing, that species starts to move over. Pretty soon it can't live above a certain elevation because we don't have any more elevation. We have very few places that are above 11,000 feet, other than maybe in the Beartooth. So pretty soon your range constriction is really great. So you have to realize that when that range gets that narrow, pretty soon you don't have the genetics to really adapt to any new systems. I'm going to skip over that. This just tells the story of the different interacting factors that play a role and how complicated it is to say, what is this species trend over time likely to be? Fire plays a big role in it. We don't predict fires all that well. The insect plays a big role in this, and we don't predict those very well. The blister rust is playing a big role, and that was an introduced species, so that has a different kind of dynamic in the system. How does competition play into that is another part of the story that's important, as are the birds that are actually distributing the seed and helping that species move around. This sort of summarizes the white bark pine research that Andy and his group did. And you can see that the future habitat starts to be limited to very small areas up in the tops of the highest peaks in our region of around the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. So we get species redistributing for lots of reasons. one of my favorites is the fact that now we have grizzly bears that are moving out into the Golden Triangle, our wheat-producing area of Montana. In fact, to the degree that they basically found a food source, and that was basically spilled wheat. And this year, I've talked to a number of farmers. This is anecdotal evidence, but they know of themselves and other people that are reinforcing the doors on the bottom of their grain bins because the bears figured out how to open them and get the grain out even after they cleaned it up in their yard so the bears wouldn't bother them. So now bears are actually a pretty common element out there in that area, grizzly bears. And they're moving into the Missouri River corridor and moving down the river. So there are all kinds of things, interacting factors, that play a role. Teasing out climate as being what its relative importance is in these factors or in these changes is really difficult. So that's the point in the real bottom line point of ecology. This is some work that we're doing. This is preliminary data. Basically, what we did is say, what's going to happen with some of the really common species that we have in Montana, plant species, the weeds, okay, the noxious weeds. And so what we did is we had a data set from the roads in Montana. The Montana Department of Transportation goes out and assesses where there's weeds present based on mile markers and where they're not. So we use that presence-absence data, and what we did is project out, first of all, what the current distribution of those weeds would be based on geographic kinds of assessment of where they are along roads, and then say this is where they're likely to be. So when you see a blue part of the line, that's when there's a presence, and the absence of the red part of the road means that those species weren't seen. So we can say what's the probability of occurrence based on their past occurrence. But then we can add to that, the next step is to add the projections using climate change. So in that we use climate variables as one of the variables, and here we use six different models that project species redistribution or climate-driven climate envelope models. And what we did is come up with a combination, sort of an averaging of those models. We call it an ensemble model, to project out what we would see in 2040. And in this case, this is spotted knapweed. Everybody's pretty familiar with spotted knapweed across the state. And what we see is that it's changing, it's increasing to some degree. It's easier to see when we actually say, where is that range deteriorating versus where it's increasing? We could see a part of central Montana where we expect it to actually deteriorate. It actually should go away, okay? Based on these factors. Now, that's just one of a long list of factors that controls where it is and where it could be. But nonetheless, it gives us some sense of perhaps how climate might be playing a role. And if we actually look at a whole set of species for Montana, starting up there with white top and spotted knapweed, Canada thistle, field bindweed, and so forth, if you look at the column that I've highlighted there on the right side, the change in the habitat, some of those numbers are negative. Some of it says some of those species should be declining. And other of the species are increasing, particularly something like St. John's wort looks like it's really going to take off. So based on climate alone. So it's not just based on climate alone. It's also based on where it has been in the past. So it's sort of a historical plus a projected piece in that. But anyway, that's an example of a species range change. So I'm going to summarize here a little bit and say the main drivers of global environmental change are atmospheric CO2 enrichment and nitrogen deposition, climate, biotic invasions, land use. Climate's just one of those factors. All these others are important as well. The atmospheric CO2 enrichment, what I didn't say about that is that affects that one group of species, those producers, the plants, in a really interesting way, and the plants use carbon dioxide. And so if you start to fertilize the atmosphere, which we are, so in the last 800,000 years, the maximum limit of CO2 in the atmosphere is about 280 parts per million. And today we're about 406. So for 800,000 years of evolution, that actually goes through about 9 ice ages. through 800,000 years, we have never been above about 280 parts per million. And suddenly, we're almost double that at 406. That's a lot of carbon. We're really fertilizing the place when it comes to a plant. So this is part of what we're not so sure what that's going to mean and how that's going to react. That could be a big positive if we're producing crops, particularly a crop with a particular physiology that can respond to that better than others. But what we don't know is when all those other interacting things, what really comes out the other end. So that's an important point. The drivers, those drivers up there tend to cause extinctions. We're confident of that. We've seen those increase. Alter species distributions. We're confident of that. We've shown you some examples. And it impacts antagonistic and mutualistic interactions among species. This is the one that gives us the most heartburn, I guess, as an ecologist, is trying to understand how does it alter competitive interactions among plants and animals. The multitrophic effects on the decomposer in the food web. How does it weaken mutualism in involving plants, enhance herbivory, variable effects on predation. So all those kinds of things are going on there, and it's really not an easy thing to determine exactly what those outcomes will be. So summarizing from that paper in 2008 that basically looked at, like I said, 680 studies around the globe, they sort of summarized with these ideas that a recurrent finding is that there is substantial variability among studies in both the magnitude and direction of effect of any given global environmental change driver on any given type of biotic interaction. So, uncertainty in what we can say is our generalities. Higher order effects among multiple drivers acting simultaneously create challenges in predicting future response. Extrapolating these complex impacts across entire networks of species interactions yields unanticipated effects on ecosystems. And challenge will be to determine how biotic and abiotic context alters the direction and magnitude of this global environmental change effects on biotic interactions. So this is an area that I say we shouldn't take a chance. We shouldn't take a chance. We don't know enough to not play the precautionary role. We need to be precautionary. And this is really, really an important time because we don't understand systems well enough to make any of these predictions. So that's precisely why we should be precautionary. And how's it going to hurt? How's it going to hurt? Are we really going to be disappointed because we can't drive our large diesel truck? We're not going to expect farmers to go out and not use their large tractors. Of course not. But we have to figure out ways to make up for those impacts. So I think that's really, really important.